Hello, my name's Henry Goldstein from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 17. The wheels are in motion for our next edition, and you can find out more at dftb18.com. Enjoy.
It's been a busy night in the adult emergency department, and when I turn up at 8 o'clock in the morning for my shift, all the beds are full already. I take a handover from the night team, thank them for their hard work, and tell them that they should go home and get some rest. Thankfully, there aren't too many new patients waiting to be seen, and there's a whole host of fresh-faced day doctors to see them. So I think that the best use of my time as the ED consultant is to do a face-to-face ward round of all the patients who've been waiting for beds overnight. When I reach his cubicle, it's empty. He's not there. The sheets are all crumpled on the bed. There's a drip stand that holds an infusion bag of something, but it's connected to nowhere. The patient has gone. I ask the nurse where he is. In the toilet, he tells me. And then he gives me a look. In the distance, I can hear the sound of retching, and I'm sure I see the nurse roll his eyes. Tell me about him, I say. The patient is 62. That's pretty young, I think, still working age. The nurses know him well, too well. We do not get on, the nurse tells me, but I could tell that already by his tone and his body language. And the paramedics don't like him either. He's difficult, and he's rude. And he's come in with chest pain, I ask, remembering the handover. Yes, the junior doctor says. She's sitting at the desk finishing some notes before she goes home from her night shift. He has cardiac chest pain and ECG changes. He gets it about once a week. He always calls an ambulance, and then he refuses to let them take him to the PCI center. So what are we supposed to do with him? The nurse looks at me. He's got morphine at home too. I honestly don't know why he even comes here. The junior doctor tells me they won't take him on the cardiac ward, and he refuses to go to coronary care. Usually he just self-discharges. I guess we're waiting for that. And then the door opens, and I see him there, stony-faced. My heart sinks. I wish I'd just stayed out of it. I steel myself, and I think how much I need another cup of tea, or maybe even something stronger, and it's not even 8:30 in the morning. Thankfully, I don't feel like this very often in the pediatric emergency department. And that, I think, is because things are different there. Even when there are children everywhere and that cacophony of stereo screaming that cuts to the very heart of your soul is going on, there is someone smiling. Usually that six-month-old just peering over their parent's shoulder and catching your eye. The patients that we see there are different. Our patients in pediatrics are afraid. We recognize that fear, and we know it's going to make everything that we do harder. So we take time. We sit down, we smile, and we talk. And more importantly, we listen. We address their fear with communication and explanation. The patients we see in pediatrics are small. So we have to think carefully about the treatments we give them, and we tailor them to the patient in front of us based on their age and their weight and their need. We have to think a bit more holistically about analgesia because we can't just stick in a cannula and give 10 milligrams of morphine, not least because that would be inappropriate for most of our patients. But we think about non-medical ways of treating pain too, like splinting fractures. And we think holistically about other treatments. We have icy poles and ice blocks, fruit juice and ice cream for the children who don't want to eat, but we really need them to. Our patients are innocent. They come with a clean slate. They don't make assumptions about the world, and we rarely make assumptions about them. That hostile, aggressive, frequent attender, we hardly ever see that in pediatrics. And labels are rare for our patients too. And in the rare times that we do encounter bad behavior, we forgive readily without them having to ask us to. The culture in pediatrics is different as well. We focus very much on the family. When we see a child, we expect there to be a family there with them. And we don't just acknowledge that family. We take time to interact with them as well. We sit down, we introduce ourselves to everyone in the room, and we engage them, even the other children who are present. We do this, and we embody these core principles of communication without thinking about it. We are holistic in the care that we deliver. We know that Maslow's hierarchy of needs tells us what everybody needs in their life, and it sits at the center of the care we deliver. So we ask questions about eating, about drinking, about toileting, about sleeping, about love. And we provide and we support those things in our departments, placing appropriate emphasis on their importance. We try really hard not to wake up sleeping children unless we absolutely have to. And we are humble in pediatrics. We realize there's no place for arrogance, because every once in a while, a child who we've seen with a viral upper respiratory tract infection and sent home comes back with meningococcal sepsis. We know that that happens. We've seen it too often. We know that most of the illness and injury we see in our patients is minor, but we also know that it can be really hard to tell for us. So we recognize that it's hard for families too. We don't dismiss the concerns of our patients and their families because we've seen that we can be wrong, that things can change, that disease can evolve, that we can get burnt. So we make sure to tell people that it's okay to come back if they're concerned. And we validate the concerns that brought them to us in the first place. The staff in pediatrics are different too. Our staff see frailty. We see the vulnerability of children. And that helps us to see them as people and breeds a kind of can-do attitude. We work together with our specialty colleagues to deliver the care that we need to. We understand that children are vulnerable in every stage of their life, and we make sure that we're invested in that. Our staff are kind. They regularly go above and beyond what's required, and they think creatively. They're not afraid to challenge the way that things are being done if they think they might not be right, as you'll know if you, like I, have ever suggested a 14-gauge cannula in a child or an arterial blood gas, even a child who's bigger than I am. Apparently, that's not okay. When there's no alternative to the things that we need to do to children, we use the illusion of choice to try to give some power back to people who are vulnerable in our presence. So we might ask a child if they want to sit on a parent's lap or on a chair for the blood test that we really have to do. But our staff are also quick to recognize when children have had enough. They recognize that everyone has had a limit and they can call for a timeout if they need one. And our staff really try to understand the world that children live in. They try to invest themselves in that. They try to speak the same language, even though it's not the language that they use. We adorn the walls and the ceilings of our departments with the faces of characters who mean nothing to us because they matter to our patients. When we see older children and young people, we recognize the evolution of identity that they're going through, and we try to give them as much self-determination as we possibly can. Our staff understand that an experience at an attendance predicts behavior at the next attendance, so we're invested in making things go well. Pediatrics is different. What we do is different. You are different. And for that, I really want to thank you all, because the care that you deliver and the way that you deliver it makes me a better clinician for all the patients I see. Because as I stand there facing this angry, hostile man, I wonder just how differently he'd be treated if he was a few hundred meters down the corridor in the pediatric emergency department and a few decades younger. So I decide to try it. I smile at him. His face doesn't change. I introduce myself. Hello, I'm Natalie May. I'm one of the emergency department consultants, and I offer a hand to shake, which he takes begrudgingly. I open, as I often do, asking what we've done for his pain. Nothing, he says gruffly. They can never get a cannula in, so they just leave me here with nothing. I frown. I'm sorry. I don't think that's good enough, I say, and I believe that. There are options here. Firstly, I'm pretty good at cannulas because I work in the pediatric emergency department. I can pretty much get a cannula in anyone. So if you're happy for me to try, I'm happy to have a look and see if there's somewhere we can get one in for you. And if it looks like that might be somewhere that's going to be a bit sore, well, we can give you some local anesthetic just under the skin with a really tiny needle, or we could put some cream on. It takes quite a bit longer to work that way, but it's still an option. But in the meantime, while that cream's working, we could give you some really strong painkiller up your nose. It works really fast. Or if you'd prefer, we could give you an injection of that strong painkiller into your muscles. Whatever you want to do, it's totally fine. And there's some non-painkiller ways we can treat your pain. We could give you some GTN, a spray under your tongue, or a tablet that sits between your lip and your gum. Or what I suggest is we do a combination of those things and we start to work our way through until we've got your pain under control. He continues to glare at me. I'm still vomiting. They haven't done anything about that either. Well, we could give you an ondansetron wafer. It just melts in your mouth. You don't have to be able to swallow it. Or if we're going to put the cannula in, I could give something through there, but we could give the wafer first so it's working while we're putting the cannula in. Or we could give you an injection either into the muscle or under the skin. There's certainly options here. We can make things better for you. A few minutes later, with the cannula in and some antiemetic and some analgesia on board, he softens slightly. I'm sorry, he says. I know that I'm rude and I'm difficult. It's just that this pain is awful and I don't know what to do when I get it. No one seems to want to help me. I've had it for over 12 hours now. I haven't been able to eat, haven't kept anything down, I haven't been able to sleep. I take a deep breath and decide that I should probably be honest with him. I think that our staff find it a bit difficult because they feel like they know what you need. They know how to help you, and that's for you to go to the cath lab, but you don't seem to want to do that. And I think they find it frustrating to know how to help you, but for you to say no. He looks at me in surprise. It's not that I don't want to go to the cath lab, he says. It's that I know it won't help me. I have stents in every vessel they can put a stent in. What I need is the bypass graft operation I'm waiting for. But, and there's a really long pause. And then when he looks at me, I see tears in his eyes. They tell me the mortality is 3%. That might not sound like much to you, but it's not nothing. That's 1 in 30. And my older brother's dying. He's got cancer and he's only got a few months left. How can I take the risk of dying before him? He's looked after me my entire life, and he looked after my mum when she was sick, and now he needs me. What if I was to die first from this operation? I couldn't do that to him or to my family. So I've told the cardiac surgeons that this has to wait. That said, I still get the pain. And it's awful, and I can't take the morphine I've got at home. It just comes up with the vomiting before it's even been absorbed. And then I understand. Here's a patient who's afraid of pain, of loss, of death. And against the healthcare system, he's certainly very small. He's suffering because we've made judgments about him. We've assumed he's not innocent. He's a person, he's a part of a family, he's a man who loves his brother. And his family has a culture, one in which looking after each other is more important than your own health. We haven't approached his needs holistically. He hasn't eaten or drunk or slept. He's a man with serious cardiac disease, and we've just left him in a cubicle all night. We haven't been humble about what's going on with him. We fail to recognize his frailty because we've been confronted by his anger. But he is a man who's in pain, both physical and emotional, and he deserves our kindness. And the risk that he talks about, the risks associated with the treatment, he's using a language that's different from ours. His understanding is different, and we have not tried hard enough to understand him and where he's coming from. He's a person. He's a patient. But he's someone's child. He's someone's parent. And actually, he could be any one of us. I thank him for his honesty, and I sincerely apologize for all the ways in which we've failed him. And he asked me to bring the nurse and the junior doctor into the cubicle so he can apologize to them too. They're a little bit surprised, but with his permission, I explain some of his context, and immediately the atmosphere in the room is different. And now that we understand a little bit more about what he needs, we're able to address some of those needs. We get him some breakfast and an extra blanket, and we turn down the lights so he can finally get some sleep. A bee can visit between 50 and 100 flowers in one collection flight, and they can pollinate 2,000 flowers a day, covering around 3 kilometers from the hive. A strong colony, collectively, can fly the distance from the Earth to the Moon every day. The difference between adult and pediatric patients is an illusion. People are people. The needs are the same. The patients aren't that different. God knows the staff aren't that different. It's the same people. So why do we behave so differently? The culture we take into our departments defines the care that we deliver. And just like a bee, the things that you do extend far beyond the department that you work in. And the way that you approach care has an impact far greater than you realize. But just like that strong colony, if we all do a little bit, we can have an impact that far, far outreaches what we could ever expect. I want to leave you with some things to think about. If you don't think this way or do those things when you see pediatric patients, why not? If you don't think this way or do those things when you see adult patients, why not? Is there one small attitudinal change that you can make tomorrow to make the hospital a happier place? If there is, I'd really like for you to tweet me that at the end of the session, because I'd really like to hear about what you guys are going to do differently. Because I really believe that when it comes to patient experience and compassionate care, it's the small things that matter, and that everything really does count, even in small amounts, and we can be the change that makes that happen. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Natalie. We definitely have had quite a strong response on the Twitter process, so I might let
The Twitter sphere response was, yes, PEDS is different, and that's why we love it. And that was the general feeling. And then Mary Freer posted a comment said, this is compassion in action, and thanked you for giving us this message. Jin Lim said, maybe we just need to do this more in all fields of medicine, so really agreeing with what you said.
Good.
And then there was a really nice comment I liked by Tom Saunders, where you had the slide with the bumblebee and had humble, and he said, I think this should read, we are bumble. But otherwise, a really great talk. Thank you.
Thank you. Natalie, just before also, we've got a few moments before we move on. I actually do have a question, and it is in regard to one of those questions you put up at the end. Wanting all of us to be able to have something very tangible and take away, with your experience in both in the clinical settings, both pediatric and the adult sections, what is the one thing that you would do to create a small change to make it happier? Because, I mean, it is a massive question. And so what would you do?
I think there's so much excellent practice and patient-centered practice in pediatrics. I think I see my role as someone who works in the adult ED as well, to stand there and say, why are we making this so hard? What would we do if this was a child? Okay, the patient's vomiting, but let's get them an ice block from the pediatric freezer. You know, let's get them some ice cream, see if they can keep that down. Okay, well, they're hard to cannulate, but they're still in pain. Why don't we give them intranasal like we would a child? So that's the change that I made after seeing this patient, was to be the person who says, we have solutions for these problems for our older patients, and there's really no difference.
I think that's a really good takeaway, is actually just look for one solution, and that might be the start of the broader conversation, because it does lead by example. So thank you so much, Natalie.